Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, and that was my interview of the now deceased investigative reporter Gary Webb, author of the Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News, and the book Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the crack cocaine explosion. And this is the weekend interview show, and I'll go ahead and bring on my next guest. He's speaking with us from tomorrow morning, Mike in Tokyo Rogers. He's a producer. He works in radio and TV. He writes often with great humor for LouRockwell.com, and he's my friend. Welcome to the show, Mike in Tokyo Rogers.
Hi, Scott. Hi, everyone.
It's great to have you on the show, man. I've been meaning to do this for quite some time.
Me too. That Gary Webb interview, that was great.
Oh, well, thanks. The book that he wrote is called Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Mike, he was found dead in his house a week ago yesterday.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, if he was killed, that's pretty sad. But the mystery kind of shrouds the other question, which is, if it was suicide, why? Because the story that ruined him had been repeatedly vindicated. And he seemed to be making his way all right when I talked to him about a year ago.
Well, you know, he, at the end of his interview, he said he'd always thought that if you tell the truth, you'll be okay. And I heard that, and I just kind of thought, yeah, I used to think that, too. you know that there's been four Bush biographers so far, Mark Lombardi, J.H. Hatfield, Danny Casolaro, and now Gary Webb. And officially, they've all committed suicide.
Well, you know, the San Jose Mercury News said gunshot wounds, and although I actually surfed around their site and tried to find a phone number to call and try to talk to the reporter who wrote that article, I imagine that could mean an entry and an exit wound, but also it could mean a double tap behind the ear, like on The Sopranos.
Yeah, from what I read, I think I've got it, yeah, he had a .38, and he shot himself once, and then shot himself a second time.
And then shot himself a second time?
Yeah. Well, that's the official story.
Oh, really?
I don't know how you could possibly do that.
Yeah, it seems once you shoot yourself in the head, you're pretty much done deal at that point.
Yeah, well, yeah, you'd think so. Anyway, so the odds of all four of those guys committing suicide are one, and I can't even count how many zeros this is. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15... One with 16 zeros after it.
Oh, no.
And according to Lou Rockwell, he sent me an email once that said that he doesn't believe at all that Danny Casolaro committed suicide.
And remind us who Danny Casolaro is.
Oh, he was one of the Bush biographers. And I believe he committed suicide, supposedly. He was suicided.
Yeah.
Maybe in 98 or 99, something like that.
We used to call that Arkanside because it was always Bill Clinton's associates that would shoot themselves in the back of the head with rifles and such. But maybe we're going to have to change the name. Hang tight right there, Mike and Tokyo Rogers. We're going to break, and we'll be right back on the Weekend Interview Show. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Talking with my friend Mike in Tokyo Rogers, all the way from the land of the rising sun, where it's very early tomorrow morning right now, I think.
Ohio, yeah, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:10 on Sunday.
Oh, wow. Well, you should be in church. Mike, I was reading something that you wrote for LouRockwell.com about war crimes, and I get the idea that America is much different to behold from across the ocean than sitting right in the middle of it.
Yeah, you know, during the war, World War II, a lot of things that what Japanese generals did, and a lot of it is a cultural thing. A lot of it has to do with logistics, but things they did when it came to the ending of the war, they were tried for war crimes. For example, there was a general in Burma, and he ran a prisoner of war camp, and British generals, and I think one of them was Mountbatten, wanted this general to be executed for war crimes because he was torturing the British prisoners. And the mode of torture was he wasn't feeding them, he was starving them. And this general, his name was 19, went to trial, and they found out that what the British thought was torture for the Japanese wasn't torture, because how he was torturing them, according to the British, was he was only giving them a bowl of rice and a boiled vegetable for breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever. But see, this is what the Japanese soldiers were eating. They didn't have supply. They didn't have the logistical capability to keep the troops supplied. That's why basically, you know, Japan fell apart so quickly during the war. And then there's other things that, like, for example, you take what's going on in Iraq now or Afghanistan, and I don't even know how to pronounce that person's name.
Abu Ghraib, yeah.
Abu Ghraib? Okay, the torture scandal that's going on there, and I think it's pretty safe to say that that is torture. It's not abuse. You abuse your wife, you see what I mean? You torture prisoners. But anyways,
it makes a good euphemism, though, doesn't it? You can't go around and introduce your nightly newscast with the word torture all the time unless you're talking about the bad guys. But our guys don't do that. They merely abuse people.
But, you know, it's semantics, isn't it? It's a game with words. And, you know, I want to get back to that about why they do that on the news. But when this Abu Ghraib scandal hit the news, I went to my usual favorite, the watering hole here, just to get the reaction of the Japanese. And I was quite surprised, because most of them were not surprised at all. They thought, oh, yeah, that's what happens in war. That's the way it is. And it boiled down to war is just something that insane people do. And
it's its own war crime. The rest just flow from the initial assault.
Right. It's like, of course things like that went on, and things like that go on during war. And I don't mean to, you know, say that it's not a serious crime, but they think, yes, you can do what you want to the lower down the ladder people, the lower ranking soldiers, but the ultimate responsibility rests with the people who created this situation.
And the more we learn about the Abu Ghraib and related torture scandals, the more we understand that this really does come from the top, especially through the reporting of Seymour Hersh, that they basically created a separate little black ops program called Copper Green outside of the chain of command, directly under Rumsfeld and Cambone,
yeah,
his undersecretary for intelligence, and that basically it's a complete whitewash to blame it on a few bad apples working the night shift at the prison when what they were doing was exactly what they were instructed to do by military intelligence.
Well, yes, I think I can speak for most Japanese people and the way Japanese people think, that it is an outrageous atrocity to blame the foot soldier when you put the foot soldier in an insane situation. And, of course, like I said, these things are going to happen. It's the people like Rumsfeld who should have to pay the penalty. And you can bet if this were a huge war, a war, like let's say in the case of like a Germany versus Russia in World War II, and the German soldiers were doing this sort of thing, let's say the American soldiers were the German soldiers doing this sort of torture, the Russian citizens or Russian soldiers, that when the war ended, that those Germans, all the way up to their leaders, would have gotten executed. But see, in this case, this is in America, this is going on at Abu Ghraib, and there will be no retribution to Bush or to Rumsfeld.
It sort of goes back
for what's going on.
it goes back to the Gary Webb interview and the fact that those who enforce the law are not subject to it.
That's right.
I mean, that's really the fact of the matter here, is that if America is the enforcer of liberty and justice around the world, well, there's nobody to be the enforcer on us.
Right.
And if they were, I don't know that the world would be any better off. I mean, if I look at it this way, Mike, if as you and I could probably agree, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Cambone and some others, at least in the military chain of command and the CIA probably as well, are guilty of war crimes, who's going to prosecute them? Because the American people love it. We turn out in droves to reelect these people. And so the question is, if we let, you know, I don't know, some Hague tribunal in Europe somewhere come and claim jurisdiction over our leaders, you know, they might as well claim jurisdiction over our lives as well.
Yeah. You know, I really have a hard time, even though I'm an American, I really have a hard time trying to understand what's going on over there. And I often, going on over there, meaning in the United States, I often get asked that question from people. And there's a lot of foreigners, too, in this country. I meet people from, you know, Belgium and Bulgaria and Romania or Thailand and then China, Iran. And they all say the same thing to me, you know, like, well, what's going on over there? Have these people lost all semblance of common sense? And I really don't know what to say, because I have a problem even discussing these things with my own family. I've basically been banished from my family. But back to the
for opposing the war, Mike?
What's that?
For opposing the war?
Oh, yes. Get this, Scott. My father was a career Marine. He was a U.S. Marine for 27 years. He fought in Korea in 1951 and 1952. 1st Marine 7th. Hello, all you Marines out there. And my father's older brother was killed in Korea, a guy who wasn't really my uncle, but their family was so close, we considered him and his wife aunt and uncle, and their kids our cousins. He was a cook in the Seabees, and he was killed in the Vietnam War. So my father has seen combat, he's seen battle, and he is the most anti-war guy you could ever meet. And this is what's strange about this, is because my older brother, and I don't know about my younger brother, I think he's a little bit ambivalent about it, but my older brother is the most rah-rah, gung-ho, you know, shoot him up, knock him down guy you could ever talk to. And this is another, you know, I don't want to really get too far off the subject, but this is another thing about American society today that I have a problem with, is you can't discuss things with people who disagree with you without them raising their voice, screaming at you, and wanting to fight. It's really astounding, because that never happens in this country. You know, usually if people disagree, they'll, you know, it's a friendly disagreement.
Well, I think it's because there's so much at stake. I mean, when you're talking about, especially when you're talking about a subject like the war on terrorism, either it's all right or it's all wrong. You know,
mm-hmm.
either the way to fight terrorism is to go to the Middle East, overthrow every government that, well, there's two left that we don't control now, overthrow the rest of the Middle East and conquer and pillage and kill as many as you can, or you stop interfering and you stop trying to provoke these people and let them perceive that they're getting justice, and so to take away their motivation to be terrorists. And it's really one or the other. And if you've decided that, hey, the war on terrorism, George Bush and then they're doing the right thing and they're bringing it to the terrorists, you know, if you're really committed to that, how hard is it? I mean, imagine how hard it would really be to recognize that, oh, wait a minute, America picked this fight and we can't win it. The only way to win is to just call it off where it's at right now. How hard would it be to go from one to the other?
Well, you know, I'm sure I won't be the first one to say something like this to you. I mean, I would hope not, but for example, to say a war on terrorism, and I work in the music business, you work on radio. Let's say, for example, we had a war on music. okay? A war on music, a war on terrorism. Let's take the same thing.
Hey, Mike, hold it right there, buddy. We're about to go out to break. Everybody, Mike in Tokyo Rogers is the guest. He writes for LouRockwell.com, and we'll be right back on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
And wondered at his final words. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, everybody, welcome back to my weekend interview show. I'm Scott, and I want to give thanks to John Statmiller, the boss up here, for letting me, first of all, run that Gary Webb interview uninterrupted by commercials for an hour there, and also for letting me call Japan so that I can talk with my buddy Mike in Tokyo Rogers. Now, Mike, when we went out to that last break, you were going to make an analogy between the war on terrorism and a war on music.
Okay. All right. So, Scott, you tell me if what I'm saying here is stupid, okay?
All right.
All right. So, because I want to try to explain this as simply as I can, and this is a gambit I used to try to explain this to my older brother, which was a failure, as a matter of fact. But for example, if you take terrorism use the analogy of music, and you say you want to destroy terrorism, okay? Let's say you want to destroy music. Well, there's no way that you could destroy music. Now, you might try to kill all the musicians. Right?
Sure, you could burn all the CDs and steamroller all the records and tapes.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about Barry Manilow and Bruce Springsteen, hey, I'm all for it. But, but you know, you could never get rid of music. And it's just like terrorism. You'll never get rid of terrorism. And the word terrorism comes from Middle French, so this word has to be at least 400 years old.
And what it really means is war by poor people who don't have an army.
Yeah, well, you know, and it goes back to what you were saying, you know. A lot of people think like, okay, we've got this war on terrorism, we have to win, or we have to lose. They never question, like, the rationale for having the war on terrorism in the first place.
Well, it really all depends on believing that history begins in 2001, and that, you know, here was this sleeping giant. In fact, this was a phrase that I thought was pretty funny. Everybody knows about, I forget, maybe you can tell me, Mike, in Tokyo, the name of the general who, after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese general who said, I fear we have awakened the sleeping giant.
Oh, Isoroku Yamamoto.
Ah, there you go. Well, they were trying to say that on September 11th. Oh, no, they've awakened the sleeping giant. And I'm thinking, you know, we haven't had so much as a nap since 1941. There's nothing sleeping about this giant. And you'd have to believe that we really were just bumping along, minding our own business, when all of a sudden these terrible people who hate our freedom came and attacked us for no good reason at all.
Well, that's absurd. A lot of people who have told me, you know, the world changed on September 11th, I don't think the world changed at all. In fact, I think September 11th, and after September 11th happened, a lot of Americans have told me, well, you know, we have to get revenge. These people have to pay. I believe that September 11th was revenge.
Of course, they say the same thing we do. Americans say those people, they only understand one thing, force. Well, that's exactly what they say about us. That's why they did what they did.
Yeah, and when you realize that, when you think about that, what sentence you just said, those people only understand one thing, and that's force or power, whatever. When you think about that, those people, who are those people? Are we talking about some poor, you know, husband and wife in Afghanistan living in some village who, you know, shucks rice to make a living? Those people? Who are those people? You know, because the leaders of the countries or the leaders who do these things are rich. It doesn't matter whether it's Bin Laden or it's Bush or all through history, the leaders of the countries are always rich. And a lot of these wars have nothing to do with education, and they have nothing to do with whether they like your freedoms or not. People don't like other people coming over to their house and screwing around. And in the case of the Middle East, you know, they can't fight against the U.S. military. So that's where terrorism is erupting. And I know in the West a lot of people have gotten in trouble for saying what I'm about to say, but, you know, if you came over to my house and your soldiers killed my mother and father, killed my wife and kid, I'd kill you. I don't care how I would do it. I'd put a bomb on my waist or whatever, and I'd walk over to your house. And when you're in there, I'd kill you. And you put me in that situation. You put me in such desperate straits that, you know, when people are seriously clinically depressed and have these kind of psychological problems, they'll do all sorts of things.
You know, it's
your
even,
imagination is the limit.
It's really even worse than that, Mike, because it's not just that they lashed out at us in the attack of September 11th, but from what I've learned, especially since reading A Pretext for War by James Bamford, but also when reading the transcript of Bin Laden's video from the end of October, that this was a trick. This is Operation Bleed America Dry. This is slap America in the face right in front of its girlfriend and force him to chase you down the street where all your friends are waiting for him. And so, you know, here's America. We've gone running full speed straight into their sand trap where all of our guys were out of rifle range. We're safe in North America. And yet now we've sent all of our guys to their land where they're within range of a rifle muzzle.
Yeah. And the problem for me when it comes to dealing with people who are so rah-rah war.
Oh, hold it, Mike. Sorry, man. We're going to break. Be right back. Darn commercial. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. And the guest is Mike in Tokyo Rogers. He writes for LouRockwell.com.
Hello.
And it's so good to have you on the air. I've been meaning to do this for a long, long time, Mike. And so far it's working out just great, I think. How about you?
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm having a great time.
You know what we were just talking about and I'm going to ask you a question, Scott.
All right, sure.
Because I'm really unsure about this. When I bring up about the war on terrorism, and what I think about it, I do find that a lot of Americans get very defensive and angry. So my question is, and I like to believe that people in their hearts know that it's messed up. But for example, let's say you have a neighbor who's got a kid who's stupid, right?
Yeah.
He knows his kid is stupid, but he doesn't want you to tell him that his kid is stupid.
Right.
And he gets mad and defensive when you tell him that. I'm thinking that, come on, people must know that there's something wrong here.
Well, it depends on which people. I mean, you got to figure, Mike, when you break down all the demographics and what have you, some of the people who pay attention are absolutely disgusted. Some of the people who pay attention love it and feel that they're part of the winning team and are nothing but cheerleaders. And you have all kinds of people. I think, you know, people that I come across most often are people who know how terrible it is, but they don't keep up with it. They don't read the news. They don't pay attention. They know it's all criminal and evil, and they don't imagine that anything that they could do in their entire life would ever change anything, so they don't even try. So like G. Edward Griffin says, if you're in a lifeboat out on the open ocean and there's a hole in it, well, dang, I guess you're just going to, you know, live for another couple hours and then sink and die. But if there's an air pump in there, you're going to stay awake for a week and a half if you have to keep pumping air into that raft. If you believe that you can affect the outcome, you'll do something. But if you don't, you know, why not just stay home and watch Cheers reruns?
Well, this goes to what you just said about the winning team. Now, you know, a lot of the people, a lot of the readers who send me email, I find that when I talk to veterans, ex-military people who have been in combat, I'm not saying they always agree with me, but they're always congenial and polite, and we can discuss this on a very, you know, intelligent level. You know, I respect you, you respect me. But when I talk to people who have no military experience, and they are the cheerleaders, they're the ones who become quite vitriolic. and very rude to me about that. And that's one thing I can't understand. Is if you're so, you know, gung-ho about this, nobody's stopping you from going down to sign up. In fact, they need people.
Yeah, they're on stop-loss order number 13 right now. Go ahead and sign up.
You know, they sent a 70-year-old general to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I read about that.
So, you know, we wouldn't have a problem.
Well, there's another half of that question, too, Mike, which is how come the guys who have been in a real war can be civilized, even when they disagree with you? It seems to me like maybe after being in a real conflict, they know the difference between a disagreement over email and something that's really worth getting upset about.
I think it has a lot to do with you come to a realization that, you know, let's say you're sitting in some hole in the ground somewhere and people are shooting at you and they're trying to kill you. And this is something that a couple of soldiers have told me. They realize it's not personal. It really has nothing to do with you. Those guys are fighting for whatever reason they're fighting for. And you know, every war that the United States has ever had, except for after 1842, it was always overseas. And the American soldiers, maybe the first few times they get shot at, they get mad, or their buddy gets shot at, they get mad. But then, if you're intelligent, if you're the kind of person who does soul searching, you'd realize that it really has nothing to do with you. And then if you follow that logic that it has nothing to do with you, then you start questioning, why am I here? I don't hate these people, you know? And I think that's what's going on with our U.S. troops in Iraq right now. And I think it's going on much, much more than the news would actually let on to.
Sure, I agree with that. And in fact, as much as the news has let on, there's been quite a bit of that. And especially, you know, it's been so long since we fought a defensive war that, you know, I think any soldier with any real intellect over there has got to be wondering what the heck they're doing getting shot at over there to secure Fallujah or Mosul or whichever city it is that they lost control of again this week.
Yeah. Well, we lost Mosul and they're still fighting over Fallujah.
It's interesting to me how you say, like, the soldiers have they've externalized it. They understand, okay, this ain't personal. I'm just doing my job and these people are just defending their home and it's not that personal. Whereas you take your average Chicken Hawk, say, Fox correspondent or maybe his biggest fan in the TV audience, they really internalize this. They make it really their fight. And so, therefore, it's much harder for them to maybe understand a different point of view about it than someone who's actually, you know, really involved in the fight overseas.
That's right. You know, when you don't have to be there, it's vicarious thrill.
Yeah.
And you can just turn it off. You just turn off the TV and then you go out to the Kentucky Fried Chicken or the whatever, 31 flavors ice cream, and you have your ice cream, and you can turn it off. It's just like a computer game, and when you come back, you can turn it on. Now, there's a lot of people here in Japan who, you'd be surprised, just about every Japanese is glad that Japan lost the war.
Really?
They may not be happy about the way Japan lost the war, meaning the atomic bombs and firebombings of Tokyo, but they are glad that Japan lost the war. And they are glad that Japan lost the war to the United States and not to the Soviet Union. But that being said, a lot of the folks here, and just about everybody, you know, who's my age, their parents, or they all know somebody who lived in a house that was bombed or in a village that was bombed or people who got killed or people who went to the army. And they're terrified of it. They don't want to have anything to do with it, you know.
That brings up another question that's kind of been bothering me. I wonder, why is it that we don't have, say, for example, Japanese or Vietnamese suicide bombers? With all the meddling that we've done, it seems like the Middle Eastern types are far more willing to hold that grudge and carry out an attack later on, whereas it seems like the Japanese and the Vietnamese, when those wars were over, they were just glad they're over and let's try to open up commercial relations and get along and not hold those grudges so much.
Okay, well, this has a lot to do, Scott, with cultural and religious differences.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, Thailand, Southeast Asia, Japan, these are Buddhist countries. and religion teaches a different type of thought than Middle Eastern countries would follow Islam. Because Islam is kind of very close to Jewish religion in that they follow the first of the Old Testament, whereas Buddhism doesn't follow the old or the new.
Right.
And Buddhism teaches you to live for the now, because there is no tomorrow, and make the best out of what you got now. Whereas in Islamic religion, and in the first, or in the Old Testament, they talk about eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. And I do know several, I do have several friends, well, Iranians are not Arabs, but I do have several Arab friends. And there's a joke going around in the Middle East now, and I just heard this maybe 3 or 4 days ago. I'll tell it to you. This guy, he sees his friend, and he says to his friend, "Do you remember 25 years ago that man who shot my daughter?" The guy said, "Yes." And he said, "Yes, well, I went to the, you know, I traveled 4 days from other village to see him." He said, "Oh, yeah?" He said, "So I shot him and killed him." He said, "Oh, when was that he did that? He shot your daughter?" And he said, "Oh, 25 years ago." He said, "So you went and shot him?" He said, "Yes." He goes, "What was your rush?" So, see, these people will hold a grudge, whereas in a Buddhist country, they won't. And that's why at the end of World War II, a lot of the Shinto religion, which believes the emperor is God, are the ones who are hardcore right-wing militarists, whereas Buddhism naturally flows towards a more peaceful state of mind. And so when the militarists, the Shinto religion believers, took over the Japanese government, that's what led Japan to war. But most of the Japanese are Buddhist. So when the war ended, that's why you didn't have an insurgency in this country. So they were just kind of like, oh, glad that's over. And a lot of the Japanese who went to war or who were kamikaze pilots or did these things, nobody wanted to go. But because of the way this society is, you couldn't say, "I don't want to go." Because in a Buddhist culture, you don't really belong to yourself. You belong to your family. And for you to say, "I don't want to go," or "I'm going to run away from the war," or whatever, would be to bring shame to your family. And you just can't do that. Well, I mean, I could, but, but they
well,
can't.
I'm not much of a collectivist, Mike, but I guess I prefer family collectivism to state collectivism. And, you know, it's funny, I actually saw something about the kamikazes on TV not too long ago where they were interviewing some of the pilots, and they said, you know, the American caricature of, you know, these guys doing it for the emperor was ridiculous, that they said they never heard of anyone say that they wanted to go kamikaze anything for the emperor. They were just trying to keep foreign invaders out of their land, and it was the last-ditch effort to protect their families. Simple as that. Plain old human response. Nothing magical or religious or fanatical about it.
Yeah, and see, this is something with the kamikazes. They all came from the southern island of Japan in Kyushu. And when the war ended, a lot of the people in Kyushu in the southern island, they have animosity towards the Tokyo government and people in Tokyo, because it was their children who were sent on these, you know, airplane missions to hit these, you know, American ships and things. And like I just explained a second ago about the Buddhist thinking,
mm-hmm.
And there are, I've met lots of Japanese people, I'm serious, young people today, and I would ask them, let's say this country was invaded by another army, what would you do? And they all say, I put my hands up.
Really?
Yeah, and I say, you put your hands up, you let them come in? And they say, yeah, let them come. They're going to leave. Don't worry. They won't be here for too long. And
wow.
That's, you know, and when you think about when the Americans came in 1945, the Japanese put their hands up. It's like, well, you know, just grin and bear it and do the best you can, because it really has nothing to do with you personally, what's gone on here. It's the government versus their government. It has nothing to do with me. And that's another reason why a lot of Japanese are seem docile to the West. But they just don't care what the government does, as long as they leave them alone.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would be the reason to fight off a foreign invader, is if they're conquering your land, they're probably not going to leave you alone.
Yeah. Well, you know, they didn't like being bombed a lot, I'm sure. My mother's from Kyushu. She died in 1995. But my mother was adopted after the war. And I can tell you some interesting stories about that. Everyone on my mother's side of the family died in the war or immediately after. My mother's mother and her brothers and sisters were killed in a bombing of Kyushu. And then when the war ended, my mother's father was the president of some kind of fishing company. And he owned a fleet of fishing boats. And when the occupation forces came in, they made him sink his fishing fleet. I don't really know why. Huh. But they made him sink his fishing fleet. And after that, he committed suicide.
Oh, great.
And then my mother was adopted by another family. And that kind of brings up an interesting thing. When my mother told me when she was 7 years old, in Japan they have girls' schools and boys' schools. They're usually segregated, still to this day. But when she was a seven-year-old girl, she told me some Japanese army soldiers came to the school, and they gave them all sharpened bamboo sticks, and they told all the little girls, and they trained them how to stand and thrust sharpened bamboo stick, and the Japanese soldiers told them, you are going to die, but you are going to kill one American before you do.
Now, I can see how someone who grew up during that time would want to just go ahead and avoid war at all costs.
See, this goes back to what we very first talked about. Like, that's insane. Can you imagine that situation? Just picture it in your head for a minute. U.S. Landing craft are coming onto a beach. They're bombing it, planes flying overhead, bombing the beach, ships are blasting with their big guns. And here you've got a bunch of seven-year-old girls on the beach with sharpened bamboo sticks trying to stab American soldiers, and the American soldiers machine-gunning them down. Now, if that's not insane, I don't know what is.
And yet it's just par for the course, typical wartime behavior. That's the kind of thing that happens.
That's right, and that's why, you know,
a little insanity under the headline of really big insanity.
Well, you know, like in Africa, they have a problem with children soldiers. I don't know if you see that too much in America, but I often see German and British TV and French TV, and they show it a lot here.
About the wars in the Congo and such.
Yeah, Congo. And Zaire and places. And
well, there's something on the front of my New York Times today about UN peacekeepers raping little children in the Congo.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I've seen pictures of these kids. These camera crews will go there and they'll show these kids. And these kids can't be 8 years old and they're walking around with AK-47s. You know, and you've got to think about, see, for us to think that in our society, we think of course. 8 year olds a little small. Okay, we got a commercial. We'll be back with Scott Horton right after this commercial.
Thanks, Mike. Alright, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Wrapping up with Mike in Tokyo Rogers. He writes for LouRockwell.com.
Good afternoon.
Whoa, what'd you say?
Good morning, good afternoon. Sorry, it's morning here.
Yeah, it's early morning Sunday in Tokyo.
Bright and sunny.
Yeah, wrapping up. Oh, what?
It's bright and sunny here. It's going to be a beautiful day, Tokyo, today.
Well, the sun's just going down here, and it's looking nice outside right now in central Texas, I'll tell you what. Hey, I wanted to point out this to you. You wrote this article called The Fall of TV News, and it begins with one of my favorite Jefferson quotes. Hope I get this right. It's something to the effect of, were I given the choice between government without newspapers or newspapers without government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. And
that's right.
I always loved Thomas Jefferson. He was obviously clearly the most liberty-loving of all of America's founders. And I want to ask you about that. Do you really think the Internet is poised to completely replace TV news?
Yeah, I wanted to say that. The problem with newspapers, TV news, and generally radio news is if they have a sponsor sponsoring the program, everything they say is suspect. And I want to tell people listening who are listening to the show, I've been doing this business for almost 30 years, and there's been so many things that have happened that I was just disgusted with, because we couldn't say this, we couldn't say that, because the sponsor of the show wouldn't like it. And
so it's not government censorship you have to worry about.
The stations will self-censorship themselves. For example, you know, I'll give you a good example. Back in the 1950s, and this is in the United States, Chesterfield Cigarettes sponsored the evening news. And I don't remember what channel that was. Maybe it was NBC or CBS. But Chesterfield sponsored the evening news. So, of course, if you have a cigarette company as a sponsor, the news will not report anything about cancer or anything like that. But anyways, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England, was going to retire from politics. So this network sent a team out to interview him for their TV news. And during the interview, you know, Churchill always smoked a cigar, but Chesterfield wanted him to smoke a cigarette instead, you know, some product placement.
Oh, no.
And they asked Winston Churchill, will you smoke a cigarette instead of a cigar? But Churchill, bless his heart, what's this, you bloody crazy Americans? And he just canceled the whole interview and just said no. And this happened, I believe, in about 1953 or 54. Okay? So, but it doesn't matter whether the actual news itself is sponsored by some, you know, tobacco company or alcohol or some maker or whatever. If that station, let's say Channel A, they've got their 24 hours of broadcasting. Let's say in the evening they have some show like you mentioned, I don't know, Cheers or whatever.
Well, so Mike, what you're saying basically is because the Internet is basically such a low-budget project, they're really not compromised in that way. They can pretty much write what they want. And you got to be quick because you got less than a minute left here.
Okay, the Internet is the indies of media. And everyone knows, whether it's music or magazines or TV or whatever, independent is cool. And independent offers you in-depth opinions.
If you want to read what Mike in Tokyo Rogers writes, go to lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. Mike, thanks so much for coming on my show, man. This has been great.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. I've had a lot of fun.
All right. I sure appreciate it. Talk to you soon, bro.